Hello there and welcome. Today is Thursday, March 1st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the UN accuses Russia of preventing humanitarian aid from coming into Syria.
This is cynical, callous, and in flagrant defiance of the demands of 2401. Russia does not get to unilaterally rewrite the terms of the resolution they negotiated and they sat here and voted for.
Several major U.S. retailers make big changes to their gun selling policies.
We have to do something about the mentally ill not being able to buy a gun.
A not guilty plea for President Trump's former campaign manager. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the UN humanitarian chief said Wednesday that a 30-day ceasefire across Syria has not been implemented and is asking the Security Council when it will be put into effect. The Council unanimously adopted a resolution Saturday demanding the month-long cessation of hostilities to allow aid in and evacuate the critically sick and wounded, especially from rebel-held eastern Ghouta. UN aid chief Mark Lowcock said the UN and its partners are ready with trucks full of humanitarian aid and medical evacuation plans once the guns fall silent and access is granted in Syria. He also said it's impossible to bring in humanitarian aid in a mere 5 hours, the time agreed upon for ceasefires from fighting.
So if there's been no humanitarian access since the resolution on Saturday, what has happened in the last few days? More bombing, more fighting, more death, more destruction, more maiming of women and children, more hunger, more misery. More, in other words, of the same.
Syrian government forces have launched a ground assault in the rebel-held eastern Ghouta enclave near Damascus. Hundreds have died in the past 11 days alone. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Ian Lustig, political science professor at the University of Pennsylvania, what he makes of this whole situation.
This indictment adds new charges to an earlier indictment that was handed down back in October. The most important new allegation contained in the new indictment is that he paid a group of former European Union politicians to illegally lobby on behalf of Ukraine's then government, then pro-Russia government in Washington. This group was called the Habsburg Group. This was something that had not been reported on before and had not been contained in previous indictments. And he is accused of paying them millions of dollars to lobby members of Congress in Washington on behalf of Ukraine.
Apparently, Manafort had, I guess, several homes, and he had quite a lavish lifestyle to fund.
Yes, many homes and real estate and other assets across the country. One of the allegations in all these.
All right, we apologize for that. This is Ian Lustig, political science professor at the University of Pennsylvania.
It's a very sad and tragic to see what is unfolding in Syria and what has been unfolding since Aleppo, really, since it became apparent that neither the United States nor the Turks nor the United Nations were willing to do what would be necessary to stop a determined Assad government with help from Iran and Russia to obliterate its enemies by using its control of the air and its willingness to use whatever weapons and whatever measures were necessary to destroy the life and will of resistance in Aleppo. What is happening now, after ISIS has been essentially defeated and Syrian forces are no longer necessary to confront that enemy, that Assad has been able to concentrate his resources and focus on what is a kind of embarrassing situation for him, in that one of the most robust rebel areas is just 5 or 6 miles outside of his capital. He seems determined, and it seems like he will be successful, albeit with brutality that we have not seen since the height of the Iraq War, to accomplish that, reimpose his rule on areas that had for a long time held out under the control of the rebels.
Is Russia unwilling or unable to rein in Syria?
I think it's unwilling to, but it's also unwilling to say that it's not in some way trying. It's trying to establish some kind of plausible deniability that it's not actually in cahoots with Assad. And it's doing that in a rather cynical way, as our representative at the UN said, by voting for a resolution to reduce the warfare while actually taking minimal measures to do that and protecting, I think, the regime from outside interference. The fact that the United States has not said one word about what it might do or what it could do or would do if these attacks continue, even if they are shown to have included poison gas, and the fact that neither have the Turks said anything about it, suggests to me that East Ghouta will fall to the regime.
They're treating it like Aleppo, where they negotiated an evacuation of jihadist groups along with their family members.
Yes, I don't know the details, but I think that there are signs of disunity within among the groups, the rebel groups in East Ghouta, and I'm not sure, and I'm sure that that will be used by the regime. So whether or not some hundreds of people are evacuated or not, I hope as many are saved as possible, but there are over 300,000 people in this area, and I don't think we're going to see an evacuation like that. On the other hand, it's going to be difficult for the Syrian army to invade that area. They would take heavy casualties, so the prospect is for continued bombardment with all the savagery and civilian death that that implies.
Moscow and Damascus are justifying their offensive, saying they're battling members of terror groups that are excluded from the ceasefire.
Well, those are only three groups or so, and it's very obvious to all observers that there are many other rebels groups in East Ghouta besides Nusra and ISIS and Al-Qaeda. So I think that's just a phony slogan that actually many countries use when they want to go after their enemies. The United States has used it, Israel uses it, Russia uses it, and now, of course, Syria uses it. We are just fighting terrorists.
How can the U.S. pressure Russia to stop this campaign?
In the context of the posture that the United States has taken toward Russia and toward Putin in the last year, I'd say it's very difficult to think of things beyond very ruthless or very forthright and direct military action in which we would actually strike at Assad's forces. That's something which we saw the Israelis do, even risking killing, and they did kill Russians, and that has not particularly stopped the Russians from their activities and from their support of Assad. So it seems like the United States would have to do something quite bold here. And we haven't done anything like that, including the rather small strike that President Trump ordered early in his administration.
Again, Ian Lustig, political science professor at the University of Pennsylvania. And now to the other story. President Donald Trump's former campaign chair, Paul Manafort, pleading not guilty to a new set of charges that were filed against him last week by special counsel Robert Mueller, who's been probing Russian interference into the U.S. election. VOA justice correspondent Masood Farivar tells International Edition's Sarah Williams about the new charges.
This indictment adds new charges to an earlier indictment that was handed down back in October. The most important new allegation contained in the new indictment is that he paid a group of former European Union politicians to illegally lobby on behalf of Ukraine's then government, then pro-Russia government in Washington. This group was called the Habsburg Group. This was something that had not been reported on before and had not been contained in previous indictments. And he is accused of paying them millions of dollars to lobby members of Congress in Washington on behalf of Ukraine.
Apparently, Manafort had, I guess, several homes, and he had quite a lavish lifestyle to fund.
Yes, many homes and real estate and other assets across the country. One of the allegations in all these indictments that have come down in recent months is that he and his former business partner Rick Gates, who did plead guilty to two counts last week, used the money to support a lavish lifestyle, you know, buying luxury cars, paying for their kids' tuition, renovating and decorating homes, etc.
The fact, though, that Gates has, he has pleaded guilty, so he's got, an agreement with the prosecutors, and that Manafort is not, is going ahead with the trial, Gates potentially could have information that could be used against Manafort.
That is the expectation. It's very interesting how the two men who were very close once worked together in Ukraine for almost a decade, and then joined the Trump campaign and were jointly indicted back in October, have taken divergent paths. Rick Gates decided to plead guilty to two charges that could potentially spare him jail time in exchange for cooperation with the Russia investigation, and potentially in exchange for testifying against his partner, Paul Manafort. So the pressure is on Paul Manafort. We have about the new trial date that has been set for Manafort is September 17th. We have roughly 7 months, and that's still plenty of time for his lawyers and prosecutors to negotiate a plea deal, although Manafort has maintained his innocence and has vowed to fight the charges and go to trial, but we don't know what will transpire over the next 7 months.
That's VOA Justice Correspondent Masood Farivar. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. general says Iran is posing a long-term threat to Mideast stability. U.S. Olympic Committee chief is stepping down amid abuse scandal fallout. President Trump leads tributes to the late evangelist Billy Graham. And Facebook launches a job search feature for low-skilled workers. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Students and teachers hugged and cried Wednesday as they returned under heavy police guard to Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School for the first time since a teenager with an assault rifle killed 17 people and thrust the huge Florida school into the center of a renewed national gun debate. Meanwhile, retail giant Walmart said Wednesday it'll stop selling guns and ammunition to anyone under 21 years old and remove all toys that resemble assault-style weapons from its stores. It follows actions by Dick's Sporting Goods, one of the largest sports retailers in the U.S., which said it will immediately end the sale of assault-style rifles in its stores and stop selling guns to of any type to anyone under 21. More than a dozen U.S. corporations have ended partnerships with the National Rifle Association since the shooting. The NRA is one of the country's most powerful lobbying groups for gun rights. In the 2016 elections, the NRA gave $54 million in political donations, much of that during the presidential race. But on Wednesday, President Trump spoke to a bipartisan group of lawmakers, indicating his willingness to do something.
The biggest fan of the Second Amendment. Many of you are. I'm a big fan of the NRA, but I had lunch with them, with Wayne and Chris and David on Sunday, and said, it's time. We got to stop this nonsense. It's time.
Well, joining us now is Jeremy Mayer, Associate Professor of Policy and Government at George Mason University. So, Jeremy, we've heard the public outcry over guns after previous mass shootings, but this time does seem different. What do you think about what's happening?
I think there's no question that Congress is feeling greater pressure now to act on gun control than at any time, possibly since the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, or certainly since the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan. We thought they were under a lot of pressure at Sandy Hook, but I think this is bigger. It's not impossible that nothing will happen. And you know, you look at our gridlock on, say, immigration. So I suppose that on gun control, I could imagine a scenario in which the Republicans are desperate to pass something and the Democrats won't let them in the Senate pass the something because they want more. But absent that scenario, I think something will pass in the next 3 to 6 months on gun control, if only because Republicans desperately don't want to go to the midterms looking like they haven't done something.
The president initially said that he wanted to raise the age limit. It seems like he has pulled back from that at the urging of the National Rifle Association.
I would agree with that analysis. I think the president at first was making noises about seriously considering raising the long gun or rifle age to 21, because it is a kind of odd thing in our national gun laws that to get a handgun, you have to be 21, but to get an AR-15, you only have to be 18 for a legal purchase. And in fact, you can be much, much younger if you do a private sale. That's the gun show loophole. So literally 15-year-olds can get AR-15s,
right,
as long as they buy them from a friend or from somebody who's not a licensed gun owner. I think the president spoke for many people when he said that doesn't make any sense, but now he's backing away from it.
Is it safe to say that the president and many Republicans still are being strongly influenced by the National Rifle Association?
Well, it's always tough to say what is influencing them. I don't think it's the NRA donations, for example. A lot of people on the left say, oh, you've been bought. The NRA is not primarily influencing Republicans through money. Republicans are happy to have the money, but the main influence that makes the NRA so powerful is primary. In a Republican primary, almost anywhere in the country, you do not want to be on the wrong side of the NRA.
It certainly does seem like a majority of Americans are not opposed to having a ban on these assault weapons. You know, you've heard the arguments that these were made as weapons of war, not to be hunting or to be out on the street with.
So the numbers on the assault weapons ban are a lot, and I guarantee that in those last weeks before it went into effect, they would fly off the shelves like daiquiris in hell. And so we would even have a bigger problem of, we've just banned something, but it's ubiquitous among gun owners. Is the NRA going to lose? Right, because the last time the NRA lost was 1994. The last high-profile issue that they lost on a national level. And since then, in almost every state and in every Congress, they've won. Even after Sandy Hook, they won. Question is, will they lose between now and November? And I think there's a very good chance, a better chance than any time since 1994, that they will. Because they're taking some pretty strong no-negotiation positions on things like raising the age to 21. So it'll be very interesting to see if the 800-pound gorilla that is the NRA loses.
It seems like a lot of businesses are cutting ties with the National Rifle Association or in some other way taking a stand to show these kids, at least, and the public that's upset about this situation with the shootings in the U.S., that they're taking action. Walmart, just the latest, to end sales of assault-style rifles in the U.S., that would seem like a pretty big deal, even if Congress doesn't act. That's making a statement, is it not?
It is making a statement, and what I find fascinating as a political scientist is an argument could be made that corporate America is more responsive to Democratic majorities than Congress is. Isn't that bizarre that the branch of government that the founders saw as likely to be most responsive to political tides is now less responsive than corporations, which are not democratically responsive? The majority of Americans are for an assault weapons ban. We might disagree on how large a majority. We might disagree on what weapons would be falling under. But the majority of Americans didn't notice a decline in their quality of life during the 10-year assault weapons ban from 94 to 2004. And in the aftermath of these horrific mass shootings, they want to see action. Congress so far has delivered zippity-doo-dah. But corporate America, in the aftermath of the Parkland shootings, is responding to the anger of the people. And it's really a fascinating development just from
when you look at the car rentals companies, airlines, and sporting goods stores, it's pretty interesting what's happening.
Yeah, and another way to think about it is that it exposes the fact that the people who are really behind the ability of any American to walk into a gun show or gun store and buy an AR-15 with very little background check, that's a real tiny minority of Americans. And we have, through inattention, allowed a tiny minority to make us the most heavily armed industrialized democracy on Earth. It's possible that these actions by corporations indicate that the tide is turning. But the NRA is extremely powerful among Republicans. It'll be a long time before they are declared the losers.
All right, Jeremy Mayer, we appreciate it. He's the Associate Professor of Policy and Government at George Mason University. South Africa's parliament has taken a first step toward enacting a policy that would allow the government to seize privately owned land without compensation. The plan, based on a policy by the ruling ANC party, aims to correct inequalities that have hurt the nation's mostly black population. The policy has its supporters, but as VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg, it's unlikely that land will be confiscated anytime soon.
Lawmakers voted Tuesday to examine how the Constitution can be amended to allow land seizures, a move that resonates deeply in a nation where the white minority still controls much of the productive farmland. But the strongest proponent of the motion sought to reassure the nation that nothing too drastic would come of it. Here's far-left politician Julius Malema right after the vote.
No one is going to lose his or her house. No one is going to lose his or her flat. No one is going to lose his or a factory or industry. All what we are saying is that they will not have the ownership. They will have lease depending on what is the arrangement, particularly as it relates to the outcome of the constitutional review process.
That is a direct rebuke to fears that this will put South Africa on the same path as Zimbabwe, where forceful seizures of white-owned farms in the early 2000s were blamed for that nation's economic freefall and political instability. The ruling African National Congress also supported Tuesday's motion, but with the provision that expropriation cannot hurt farm production, economic stability, or political stability, a fairly large and vague loophole, analysts say. And so the loudest group in support of land seizures, the Black First, Land First movement, has denounced the motion as nothing but an electioneering gimmick by the ANC. South Africa holds general elections sometime next year. The opposition Democratic Alliance voted against the measure and blames the slow pace of land redistribution on the ANC, which has ruled since the end of apartheid in 1994. The DA Shadow Deputy Minister of Rural Development and Land Reform, Ken Robertson, began his speech by saying in isiZulu, "People are suffering."
People were dispossessed of their land and their dignity by the discriminatory laws of the past. A painful past that can never be forgotten. The ANC's call for expropriation is just a lazy attempt to divert attention away from the real reasons that lie at the heart of the slow pace of meaningful land reform and restitution.
While this debate has no shortage of fiery rhetoric, what it lacks, says analyst Ibrahim Fakir, are concrete details.
At present, all bets are off. No one knows how and what this could mean. Theoretically, it could even mean that it does actually end up denying a regime of protection of private property, because we need to begin to get better at separating the instrumental from the moral and the moral from the policy. And that work hasn't been done.
No reliable figures on land ownership in South Africa exist, although a recent government study found that only a third of the nation's land is privately owned. Any changes to the Constitution require a 75% vote, meaning 300 of 400 members of Parliament would have to approve the change. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, voters in Sierra Leone go to the polls on March 7th to elect a new president, parliament, and local councils. President Ernest Bai Koroma is stepping down after serving two terms. His presidency faced the Ebola outbreak and allegations of corruption. An in-depth discussion on the most pressing issues facing Sierra Leone. On the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, the world's biggest mobile phone trade fair, the Mobile World Congress, or MWC, opened earlier this week in Barcelona, Spain. And except for Apple, which traditionally stays away, all other big and small phone manufacturers and developers are displaying their wares as they continue to battle a market valued at close to $500 billion. VOA's George Pudyk has more.
Smartphones seem to have reached the point where not much can be improved.
I think we've pretty much hit a glass ceiling of innovation. If you look at the refresh cycles now that Samsung and Apple have in their products, it tends to be a three-year rather than a two-year cycle when you have a big upgrade.
So manufacturers turn to other smartphone features, such as the cameras. Samsung's new Galaxy S9 is basically the same as the previous model, except for the improved camera. It can make better pictures in low-light situations and can detect high-speed motion, automatically recording it in slow motion. For those who simply cannot afford the $800 phone, Google has developed a new operating system called Android Oreo Go. It's specifically designed for cheaper phones.
With Android Go apps, they take into account things like data. So on YouTube, it'll actually lower the amount of data that it takes to play a video because, well, data is expensive in developing countries.
The new operating system will be ideal for a range of affordable smartphones, such as Nokia's revamped Slider phone 8110, launched in 1996.
We are fortunate enough to have with Nokia so many awesome iconic design legends, and this year it's the 8110 reloaded, and we're bringing it back, but with 4G and Wi-Fi.
Accessories and gadgets ranging from see-through wall devices to robots also competed for customers' attention.
What we're trying to see is people beginning to try and differentiate with new accessories, new features on the phone, but allowing the user to customize their phone rather than customizing it by default.
And for those who just cannot imagine the world without selfies, there is also a machine that can print any image sent from a smartphone on top of the obligatory espresso crema. The MWC runs through March 1st. George Putic, VOA News.
Well, you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you very much for listening, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A delegation from the U.S. government's Millennium Challenge Corporation, or MCC, visited Lesotho recently to discuss the development of a second MCC compact to reduce poverty and promote economic growth in partnership with the government of Lesotho. During their visit to restart development of a second MCC compact, the U.S. delegation met with senior Lesotho government officials and political party leaders, civil society, and the private sector to discuss MCC's approach to country partnership and the compact development process going forward. Using an approach that reflects a country's own priorities, MCC provides time-limited grants and assistance to developing countries that meet rigorous standards for good governance, from fighting corruption to respecting democratic rights. Working with local partners, MCC tackles some of the most pressing challenges that developing countries face, such as access to electricity, clean water, land rights, and roads. The decision by MCC's board of directors to reselect Lesotho is acknowledgement of the government of Lesotho's actions to address MCC's ongoing rule of law concerns, including the implementation of the Southern African Development Community recommendations, said Principal Deputy Vice President Kia Kim. Lesotho's continued commitment to rule of law, accountability, and investing in its people will remain important as we work toward our shared goal of reducing poverty through economic growth. U.S. Ambassador to Lesotho Rebecca Gonzalez noted, "The ongoing positive impact of the first MCC compact is a testament to the tremendous collaboration between the United States and Lesotho, and we look for the government of Lesotho's continued commitment to these early investments. As we build on this partnership of mutual accountability, we remain committed to supporting Lesotho as it undertakes an inclusive, transparent, and comprehensive national reform process, which is essential to achieving sustainable economic growth and long-term stability."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.